Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Dispatch 12. As always, I'd like to start by thanking you for your support. We've now officially been doing this for a year, so I think it's safe to say these have become a permanent part of the show. I'm still enjoying them quite a bit, and I hope you are too. I thought we'd start this installment with a short reading. I came across this passage a couple months ago, and it is really not the kind of thing that is useful for the main narrative, but it stuck with me. It's from the memoirs of a Russian officer of Baltic German extraction named Edward von Löwenstern. In the mid-19th century, Löwenstern would rise to the rank of general in the Imperial Russian Army, but he got his start as a teenage officer cadet in the campaign we've just been discussing. Officer candidates were in an unusual position. They were elevated above the enlisted men and the non-commissioned officers, like corporals or sergeants, but they did not enjoy most of the privileges of the officer corps. As the name suggests, they were just candidates to be made officers in the future. They played many roles, often being assigned boring or menial tasks that the other officers didn't want to do. They were a bit like interns in a modern white-collar office. The real officers sometimes made a point of hazing them, to put them through their paces and make sure they were tough enough for the army. In this passage, Löwenstern describes what it was like to finally get that first promotion, to leave the drudgery of life as a candidate behind and finally join the fraternity of his regiment's officers. Löwenstern would go on to have a long career in the Russian army and received many more promotions over the course of his life. But writing about this experience decades later, I think you can still feel how much it meant to him. Quote, "One evening, if I am not mistaken, the beginning of March, I returned to camp tired and weak from foraging. Once again, we had to seek hay at a great distance, and spent the whole day riding around in a quagmire. I could barely stand up straight from exhaustion. Wrapped in my coat, I threw myself on the ground and fell asleep. Soon I was quite rudely shaken awake. 'Get going to the captain,' a hussar yelled at me. 'He has called for you several times, and has something important to tell you.' 'May the devil take the captain,' I thought, rubbed the sleep from my eyes, buckled my saber around me, and went. Full punch glasses and congratulations greeted me. I had become, consider my endless joy, an officer. I did not know what was happening to me. Was it a dream? Was it reality? Everything that had happened was forgotten. My anger towards my officers, who had treated me so roughly, was drowned in punch and wine, leaving behind a friendly feeling for my former superiors. The constantly drunk Shishkin, the strict but brave Obasenko, the dumb Emelyanov, the no-good foolhardy Borodovsky, threw themselves into my arms and were happy from the depths of their hearts. The dark, murky horizon of my life seemingly began to clear up. At least a few warm rays of sun shone through the black clouds. I could take solace in a more pleasant future. If, on that joy-filled evening, an unbidden prophet had murmured into my ear, 'Don't believe anything, it is only a bluff, you are not yet an officer,' I think I would have lost my mind." End quote. Now on to your questions. First, Anastasia Montez asked, "What are some important sources that you'd recommend for a foundational understanding of the era? Any need-to-read books or memoirs or anything of the like?" I would actually advise against getting general foundational knowledge for memoirs or other primary sources. Memoirs of prominent people with real inside knowledge of important events tend to be self-serving. These types of books are usually written with an eye towards correcting the record or answering back at critics. For instance, both Paul Barat, Napoleon's patron and sometimes rival, who served as a member of the Directory, wrote a memoir. So did Joseph Fouché, who served as Minister of Police under successive revolutionary governments. You might think both of these books would be invaluable resources, the recorded memories of two people who were right at the heart of revolutionary politics for years, and were major participants in all kinds of significant events during that time. However, if you dig into modern scholarship on the French Revolution, you'll find that they don't often cite these books. The fact is, they are not reliable. Barat and Fouché were both inveterate liars, and both wrote their books with an eye towards whitewashing their reputations, not illuminating the truth about key events they witnessed. These are just two examples. This is very often the case with memoirs of powerful people. Even more honest authors often couldn't resist the temptation to paint themselves in a better light. On top of that, many of these books were written years or even decades after the events they describe. Human memory is fallible, and most of these people did not have editors or assistants helping them fact-check. Even reading memoirs that are generally considered reliable, you often find footnotes from the translator or editor explaining that the writer got the facts wrong. For instance, in an early dispatch, I read a passage from the memoirs of Marcellin Marbeau describing the Siege of Genoa. Shortly after the part I read, he describes watching a shore battery sink a British warship. The trouble is, looking over the reports of the British blockade squadron and the records of the Royal Navy, they don't seem to have lost any ships around the period Marbeau was describing. Marbeau's description of the event is quite vivid. He probably did see something like this at some point in his career, but we can only guess at where and when. The point is, you need a fair amount of baseline knowledge to really get the most out of reading a memoir. They're great for adding color or personality to your understanding of the past, but they can also lead you astray if you don't know what you're looking at. Personally, a lot of my favorite memoirs are actually not from prominent or powerful people. You won't get much useful foundational knowledge from the memories of a junior officer, a sergeant, or a random civilian, but some of these people were keen observers and entertaining writers. My all-time favorite is probably Life in Napoleon's Army by Captain Elzéar Blas, which I've quoted from in several of the dispatches. I would also recommend the memoirs of Sergeant Bougon, the Notebooks of Captain Coignet, and the Memoirs of Madame Junot by Lord Abrantes. None of these books are particularly rich in general information. They are more focused on the experiences and perspectives of their authors, but all of them are a good read and help put a human face on the story of this era. Next, Luke Frankel asked, "Listening to the episode about the Battle of Friedland made me think about the fate of the civilians who lived there. What would civilians of this period do when tens of thousands of soldiers showed up one day? Did they try to hunker down, or had they already fled the area?" I'm generalizing quite a bit here, but rural people tended to flee, and city and town dwellers tended to hunker down. Accounts of Napoleonic-era armies moving through rural areas often take it as assumed that any local people had fled, along with their animals and as much of their food and valuables as they could carry. For armies of this period, living off the land often meant ransacking abandoned peasant homes, and sometimes poking around their fields for any unharvested crops. In areas that were frequently fought over, the local peasants might have some unofficial refuge somewhere nearby, some landmark or some specific area of the forest or the swamp, where people knew to congregate if soldiers appeared in the region, a place that would be hard to find for outsiders. Polish peasants hiding from the armies of Napoleon and Emperor Alexander in 1807 might have been using the same locations their parents or grandparents used to hide from the armies of Frederick the Great and Empress Elizabeth 50 years earlier. Residents of cities and towns tended to stick around when armies showed up. I would imagine this was in part because they had some expectation of better treatment. When rural people interacted with soldiers, it was usually in the form of foraging parties. This was a small group of men who were armed, wanted food, and with few officers around and few witnesses, they didn't have much incentive to treat the peasants with kindness and respect, to put it mildly. On the other hand, in cities and towns, armies had some incentive to maintain order. Looting and lawlessness often did occur, but urban settlements were useful. And so officers had a clear incentive to limit the damage, even if they weren't always successful. Furthermore, the arrival of soldiers was not necessarily a bad thing for city and town dwellers. A lot of these people made their living selling goods and services. Thousands of soldiers could mean thousands of customers. And unlike their rural counterparts, town dwellers might not have had the means or the knowledge to simply pack up and vanish into the wild for an indefinite period of time. Faced with the choice of braving the forbidding wilderness and facing the dangers of an occupation, many chose the latter, where they could at least try to protect their property and maybe even turn a profit. Sometimes this worked out. Think back to the discussion of the Grande Armée's time in Berlin. It would probably be a stretch to say the local people welcomed the French, but many of them were able to find silver linings to the occupation. But sometimes it didn't work out. I wound up cutting this from the last episode, but there is a heartbreaking quotation from a Russian soldier describing the residents of Friedland joining the panicked Russians in the streets near the end of the battle, trying to escape over those burning bridges. You have to imagine many of them were killed alongside all the coalition soldiers around them. In the future, we'll cover the tragic Battle of Smolensk, in which most of the city's 15,000 or so residents chose to stay when the French and Russian armies arrived in the vicinity. The subsequent battle took place in and immediately around the city, and perhaps a majority of the local civilians were killed in the crossfire. M31 Transient asked, I heard you mention once that you are a Seattle man. As a fellow from the Emerald City, I would love to hear more about this, if you're comfortable. I'll keep this brief because it's only interesting to people who know Seattle, but yes, I grew up in the Capitol Hill neighborhood, right in the city, and went to St. Joe's as a kid. I moved back here a couple years ago, although obviously not to Capitol Hill, which has become insanely expensive. So if you live in North Seattle, that might be me standing in line behind you at the grocery store. Go Mariners. Next, Snack in a Box asked, It's been mentioned a lot over the past handful of episodes about the difficulties of keeping an army fed. During this time, what would ration distribution look like for the common soldier? Were there dedicated personnel for cooking food, or was it left up to the individual to prepare whatever they were given? Were there any attempts at centralizing or rationalizing this process during Napoleon's time? Like many things in the Napoleonic era, the system of rations was sort of halfway between a modern, rational, centralized system and a much older way of doing things, in which food and drink were handled on an ad hoc basis. If you want to know what soldiers ate in, for example, the Second World War, it's pretty simple. The recipes and ingredients for soldiers' rations were carefully calibrated by government and military bureaucrats, right down to the specific weight of each individual ingredient. If you're really dedicated, you can even find surviving military rations from this era and crack them open yourself, although I wouldn't recommend eating what you find. Armies and governments of the Napoleonic era couldn't even dream of the level of resources and organizational sophistication needed to produce uniform rations on a grand scale, let alone the technology to preserve ready-made meals. Every army of this era did have a centralized system of rations. But the food they actually distributed to the men could vary quite a bit based on whatever was available or what could be had at a low price. And many of the directives they followed were quite vague. For instance, the French regulations call for the issuing of bread and meat and dried vegetables, with no specifics as to what type. And of course, as we've seen in many past episodes, armies were often simply unable to issue rations. And we know from first-hand accounts that when rations were issued, they were often incomplete or included substitutes for items that were not available. So looking at the official guidelines only gives us a rough idea of what the men were actually eating. I'd like to do a deep dive on this question, focusing on the French army. Here's a sample menu from shortly after Napoleon crowned himself emperor. 24 ounces of bread, 8 ounces of meat, 1 ounce of rice, or 2 ounces of beans, split peas, or lentils, 1 quart of wine, 2 ounces of brandy, and 1.5 ounces of vinegar. That last item might jump out at you. If you know French cuisine, you might be aware that they are fond of their vinegar, but this actually had a practical purpose. It was not a flavoring agent. Vinegar was for adding to drinking water. This was referred to as mellowing the water. It might sound strange, but this practice is actually backed up by modern science. Vinegar has disinfectant properties, and water with a bit of vinegar in it will stay potable longer than plain water. To take another sample menu, here's a directive from Napoleon's headquarters from 1809. Quote, Non-commissioned officers and soldiers will receive, in addition to their bread ration, for breakfast, soup and 1/16 a pint of eau-de-vie. For lunch, soup, 16 ounces of meat, vegetables, and half a pot of beer or wine. For dinner, vegetables, and half a pot of beer or wine. End quote. For those of you who aren't aware, eau de vie is a term for unaged, and in this era, often very low-quality, brandy. Like brandy, it is made from distilling wine grapes, but it is clear, and the flavor is much rougher. And, judging from the descriptions of soldiers' memoirs, it often had a kick like bad moonshine. Today, the French spirits industry is pretty strict about using the term brandy only for the aged product, and eau de vie only for the raw stuff. But this was not the case in Napoleonic times. When we read about French soldiers drinking brandy, they probably often meant what we today would refer to as eau de vie. Depending on the time and place, this could be really nasty stuff. Unscrupulous vendors sometimes steeped tea and spices in their inferior eau de vie to mask the unpleasant flavor and/or to pass it off as aged brandy. For the rest of their alcohol ration, French soldiers preferred wine, as you might assume. If wine was not available, it was substituted with more liquor or with beer. Generally speaking, beer was the most hated of these drinks. Some of this was probably cultural, but some of it was the fact that the beer issued to soldiers was generally of awful quality, probably closer to a failed homebrewing experiment than the type of beer you might buy in the store today. I don't want to dwell too much on alcohol, because we already did a segment on drinking in the Napoleonic armies for a previous dispatch, but this was a very important part of the ration system. According to one estimate, just over a third of the total calories in the rations issued to Napoleon's soldiers came from alcohol. If beer, wine, and liquor were three cornerstones of the French soldiers' diet, the fourth was bread. The Grande Armée took great care and devoted a great deal of resources to the production of bread. Specialized teams of masons traveled with the army whenever it was on campaign. In under 14 hours, an 8-man team of Grande Armée masons could build an oven capable of cooking 500 loaves of bread at once. Once completed, these ovens were worked by so-called brigades of army bakers. Three assistants who kneaded the dough, and a brigadier who formed the loaves and managed the baking process. Under ideal conditions, an experienced brigade of just four bakers with one oven could produce as many as 3,000 loaves of bread in one day. Usually they cooked from the standard French army recipe for so-called pain de munition, literally ammunition bread, 3/4 wheat flour, 1/4 rye flour. By our standards, this bread would probably seem very dense and lumpy, and it was probably a lot more nutritious than what we're used to. It was usually formed into rings, so a large number of loaves could be carried on a rope tied into a loop and slung over the shoulder. Once the bread was distributed to the regiments, it was stored on a special shelf suspended from the ceiling to prevent mice and rats from getting to it. Unsurprisingly, French soldiers were very particular about their bread. They preferred wheat flour, but this was not always available, especially in Eastern Europe, where the staple crop is rye, not wheat. And so the army often issued all rye black bread instead. The French soldiers considered this inferior, but for Napoleon's Polish and German troops, black bread was a taste of home, and most of them actually preferred it. When fresh bread was not available, with a product they referred to as biscuit, what we today call hardtack. We've discussed this in past episodes, but to quickly review, hardtack was essentially oversized crackers, about the size of the palm of a hand, made from wheat flour. It was baked twice, long and slow at low temperatures, to remove any trace of moisture. With close to zero water content, if stored properly, hardtack can last for years without spoiling. In fact, under ideal conditions, it can remain edible decades after it was baked. However, edible is maybe a bit too generous of a description. Hardtack was almost impossible to eat as it was issued. It had to be soaked in liquid, or broken up and cooked into a soup, to become soft enough to eat without the risk of losing a tooth. It was also frequently infested with insects. This was generally not something soldiers actually enjoyed eating. Hardtack was an emergency food to keep them going when nothing else was available. As they marched into Russia in 1812, French soldiers were ordered to carry 4 days' worth of hardtack in their knapsacks. So, when we talk about rations not being issued, many of the soldiers would have at least been able to rely on their hardtack. It wouldn't have been very nutritious, but it at least provided some calories and stopped their stomachs from rumbling. The Grande Armée also issued raw flour to the troops. This was the cheapest and most space-efficient way to issue carbohydrates to the army, but obviously it required them to cook it themselves. Sometimes they were able to find or even build ovens and bake their own fresh bread right at the front. But this would much more commonly be used as a thickener or to make dumplings in a soup or stew or to make ash cakes in a campfire. In every French army unit, the men were divided into messes, groups of 15 soldiers who all shared a common set of cooking and eating implements. Interestingly, although there were 15 men in each mess, they were not issued 15 mess tins, so the men either had to provide their own bowl or plate, or pair off and share a tin with a comrade. In theory, the 15 men of each mess were supposed to take turns cooking for the whole group, but in practice, this often became a permanent duty for one of them who had experience in a professional kitchen or simply had a flair for cooking. Multiple messes often pooled their resources to let one experienced chef do the cooking for the whole group. In some cases, a particularly skilled cook might do the meals for the entire unit. Of course, taking on this huge task meant this man was excused from other duties. Apparently, these unofficial regimental cooks were sometimes even spared having to go into combat. One French memoirist joked that while even senior officers could be easily replaced, a good cook might only come around once in a blue moon. Almost any source you read about the ration system of the Grande Armée talks about corruption. From the civilian contractors who supplied the army, to the bureaucracy that managed it, to the man who handled the logistics, right down to the supply officers of individual units, rations passed through a lot of hands, and many of these men helped themselves, either to the food and drink, or to some of the money meant to purchase it. On top of illegal corruption, there was a lot of perfectly legal price gouging by civilian contractors. Every single government and military commander of this period was locked in a constant struggle with the contractors. The obvious solution was to bring the tasks undertaken by the contractors in-house, have the army's own support units take over from the private companies wherever possible. Some of France's best minds worked on this problem, including the longtime war minister and all-around genius Lazare Carnot, Napoleon's brilliant, exacting chief of staff, Louis-Alexandre Berthier, and even the emperor himself. But this was a tall order with the level of organization and money available, and none of them were able to achieve anything more than minor reforms. Between corruption, shortages, and the army outmarching its logistics system, soldiers often had less than they needed. However, not all units suffered equally. The Imperial Guard had its own separate supply and logistics system, which was, generally speaking, better funded and staffed than the system that served the regular army. A big part of the lure of joining the Imperial Guard was the prospect of better and more reliable rations. There were also individual officers who took the initiative in making up for any shortfalls and ensuring supplemental food was available to their men. Part of what separated good leaders from average leaders was their ability to secure food for their units. Not only did it help them ingratiate themselves to their troops and keep up morale, their men probably performed better with extra calories. Because the simple fact was, Napoleonic soldiers were chronically undernourished. Their rations were short on many key nutrients, and were simply not enough for young men living physically active lives. One scholar estimated that the average French army ration of this period contained just shy of 2,500 calories per day. Modern nutritionists will tell you that's just barely enough for a person with a sedentary lifestyle. For someone who spends their days marching, fighting, and doing manual labor, it's nowhere near enough. Worse, up to a third of those calories came in the form of alcohol, probably the worst possible way to keep your body fueled. An archaeological study of bones found in a mass grave of French soldiers from this period found that about 70% of them suffered from osteoporosis, a medical term for reduced bone density. In otherwise healthy young men, osteoporosis is generally considered a telltale sign of chronic malnutrition. The lives of Napoleon's soldiers were very hard, there's no question about it. However, it is worth mentioning that in this era, chronic malnutrition was in no way unique to soldiers. One French officer estimated that 3/4 of his men ate better in the army than they had in their former lives, as peasants or poor workers. Of course, that's easy for a relatively privileged officer to say, but based on what we know about poverty in France at this time, he might have been right. True or not, I would not recommend adopting the diet of a soldier in the Grande Armée. Even if you're an ultra-hardcore reenactor, probably best to sneak a protein shake and some supplements when no one is looking. Anyway, that's all for now. Once again, thank you for your support.